From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. Change is on the way in Baltimore's public housing. RAD is the Rental Assistance Demonstration Program. Will it bring private money into the city's rundown public dwellings or make those units unaffordable? We hear what's at stake from the Housing Authority, critics, and longtime residents. Then how can we eat in an ethical way? Tom Hall asks Dr. Ruth Faden of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics about how our eating habits affect our environment. Plus, theater critic J. Wynn Russick reviews Last of the Boys, a play about the Vietnam War's impact on those who fought and those left behind. And Baltimore native Andy Abramowitz tells us about his funny debut novel, Thank You, Goodnight, about a one-hit wonder songwriter reuniting his band and figuring out his values. Now news.
I'm producer Jonna McCone. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
It's Maryland Morning on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. The frustrations that have convulsed Baltimore this spring have roots in police practices, yes, but also much deeper roots, roots that stretch back over a century in a history of various government policies that made racial segregation official. Take public housing, which has existed in the United States for nearly eight decades. As in many other places, government housing assistance in Baltimore has been a central safety net for the poor, but it also has perpetuated generational poverty and racial segregation. In the last 20 years, new approaches have been tried to replace government-owned high-rises, for example, housing vouchers or rent subsidies in privately owned buildings. Now there's another new idea, and Baltimore is one of the cities trying it out. It's called RAD, or Rental Assistance Demonstration. Proponents say it will bring long overdue funds into public housing in poor neighborhoods, but critics say it will let private businesses control a federal program that should remain just that, publicly funded. Jonna McCone has been following Baltimore's public housing changes for the past year. She brings us this story on public housing's future and its past.
We're standing here at McCullough Homes. It was actually one of the first public housing developments that was erected by the Housing Authority at the time.
Lawrence Brown is a professor at Morgan State University. He studies how disinvestment and segregation affect health. In short, how policies in the past shape the Baltimore of today.
McCullough Homes function as a buffer between, to our west, what would have been black Baltimore at the time, and to our east, across State Center, there's the Bolton Hill community, which is white. And so by placing this here, it basically said we're going to do everything in our power to keep a divider between, so this would be a black community, and that's going to stay a white community.
Public housing was created in 1937. In the quarter century that followed, millions of African Americans left rural areas, and cities became more segregated. Housing projects were often built adjoining those segregated communities. Susan Popkin is a researcher at the Urban Institute. She's written several books on public housing. She says even though housing projects displaced people from slums and tenements, many were delighted by the new accommodations.
It was so much better than what they had before. They had a shower, they had a bathtub, you know, they had electric lights, and as bad as it looks to us from this vantage point, you have to think about where people were starting.
To hold down costs, housing projects were big. They housed huge numbers of people. Many communities were isolated and segregated by highways, and over time, residents included fewer working families and more of the very poorest. By the 90s, the aging buildings had deteriorated.
Public housing, you know, quote unquote, failed in a very public way. And they needed to come up with a solution that addressed the problem in a very visible way.
Eva Rosen is a sociologist and postdoctoral fellow at Harvard.
We could see the violence across the country in these poor neighborhoods. We could see the state of the buildings. We saw images of police trying to go into these developments and deal with crime. We saw images of just the state of the apartments on the inside, the holes in the walls, the elevators not working, lights out in the stairways. And these are problems we still actually hear about.
During the 90s, Baltimore's most troubled and dilapidated high-rises came down. Lawrence Brown says it wasn't just the high-rise model that had failed.
A lot of times they were demolished because the Housing Authority of Baltimore City did not adequately take care of them. They mismanaged funds. They did not fix up public housing. They did not keep it maintained properly.
A few examples from the 90s. The agency paid millions of dollars in settlements, in part because the authority let its lead insurance lapse, and the federal government reclaimed over $100 million in unspent money. In the mid-90s, people were transitioned to mixed-income developments, low-rises or the housing voucher program. With vouchers, families pay a portion of their rent to landlords based on their income. HUD covers the rest. Again, Eva Rosen.
So this is a way of relying on housing that already exists in the public market and relying on privately owned properties to house the poor.
Rosen lived in Park Heights for a year starting in 2011. She studied the neighborhood for its mix of homeowners and renters. Rosen found that some landlords are concentrating vouchers in the very neighborhoods the program was designed to get them out of.
They recruit tenants, they select tenants, and they make decisions about who they want to keep. And in particular, it turns out that landlords who have properties in more disadvantaged neighborhoods have a sort of a perverse incentive to attract voucher holders to these neighborhoods.
She says landlords are less likely to rent to voucher holders in more affluent communities because they can easily find tenants to pay those rents. In poorer neighborhoods, landlords are more likely to end up with tenants who struggle to pay rent.
And so if they're able to attract a voucher tenant to this unit, then they're able to collect whatever the housing authority sets that rent at, which tends to be often as much as a couple hundred dollars more a month than they might be able to get from a market tenant. So they're able to get more rent, and they're also able to get the rent that they do get on time.
Housing vouchers represented a new way to house those who need it. Not all Baltimore's housing complexes have been knocked down, though. The city still owns about 22 buildings, many in poor shape. Peter Engel of the Housing Authority oversees the redevelopment of public housing.
The Housing Authority of Baltimore City estimates that we have a backlog of deferred maintenance and capital needs to do roofs, windows, heating systems, all of that sort of capital work. We have a backlog of about $800 million for our roughly 11,000 units.
Under a new program called Rental Assistance Demonstration, or RAD, real estate companies don't just lease to people in their buildings, but actually buy a part of the housing projects. At a meeting in Park Heights last year, Housing Commissioner Paul Graziano told residents the city is in a bind. With the funding that comes out of Washington, it would take 200 years to fix the buildings. He asked the PAC room if they want the 200-year plan or the 2-year plan. Sharon Jones of Bell Park Towers went to the meeting. She plans to keep close track of RAD and question developers' incentives for renovating.
And I know these people want their money back, so what price do we have to pay for them to get their money back?
Peter Engel of the Housing Authority says RAD frees up money unavailable with the traditional housing model by converting public housing subsidies to Section 8 subsidies.
What it allows the Housing Authority to do is to go to the private sector to borrow funds and to use the low-income housing tax credit program. And both of those programs allow us to bring in a lot of capital to rehab these buildings.
Since the 90s, this public-private model has developed mixed-income communities around the nation. Sociologist Ed Goetz, who wrote New Deal Ruins, says that's a complete rethinking of public housing.
From a design standpoint, from the standpoint of no longer being a public program exclusively, but one that is really focused on attracting private sector investment. It has been driven by this logic of dispersal and deconcentration of poverty, which has justified the demolition of a lot of units of public housing and the loss of that housing stock.
Though RAD won't result in a loss of units, some residents, like Gary Shroud, are concerned about permanent affordability in a city where there are 70,000 on the waiting list for subsidized housing.
We are the backbone of Baltimore! We are the workers!
Shroud led a rally against RAD last year. He lives in Bernardi Mason Senior Apartments in West Baltimore and has been organizing with the Right to Housing Alliance.
And now you want us to live where nobody wants to live? We don't think so!
Shroud says the original plan was to sell the land, the building.
The whole 9 yards. We had to speak out. They decided they wouldn't sell the land.
The Homeless Persons Representation Project, other legal groups, residents, and the Housing Authority have been working to negotiate RAD's implementation. Advocates say initial policies would have effectively screened out new residents who most need the housing subsidy. They've also been looking at other cities rolling out RAD, because even though it's a federal initiative, local housing authorities shape the details of how it happens. Another change hammered out along with residents was leasing the land public housing is on, rather than selling it. As it stands, the Housing Authority has the option to buy the RAD projects back in 15 years when the low-income tax credits expire.
We don't know a lot of things, but HABC will be in the driver's seat because we have the right to buy it back, and that's what's important. So that means at that time, people will be able to evaluate the situation, and if it makes sense for us to buy them back so that we can refinance them again, rehab them again, keep them strong for another 15 or 20 years, I'm sure that's what people will do. If, on the other hand, with the way financing works and the restrictions have all been working and the buildings are still serving the people they're supposed to serve, we'll have that opportunity to keep the development entity or the ownership entity in place, refinance that way, and make sure that they'll continue to be, again, affordable for this very low-income population.
I reached out to a few of the 11 developers listed on the Housing Authority's website. The community builders got back to me but said they can't comment because the contracts are still in negotiation. The unknowns leave many residents worried about the future. A meeting a few weeks ago showed miscommunication between the Resident Advisory Board, the group that communicates with the Housing Authority, and tenants.
And you need to get together with the tenant council, whoever they and get this stuff right and work it out, because I'm not going nowhere.
So there's a lot of misinformation.
That's Gary Shroud from the RAD protest. He helped facilitate the meeting.
When you privatize, you should be able to have a voice in it. You know, the public, the people that it affects should be able to have a voice in it. I'm not organizing a gang to go out here and commit crimes. I'm organizing people to understand where they live, how they live, what they can do to help themselves live better. If you don't know what's going on, you can't help yourself.
Shroud says the Housing Authority has not made it easy to understand the complex changes taking place. He wants people to take more ownership of where they live and not feel intimidated to do so. That's the kind of bottom-up change, he says, that could get people out of poverty long-term. Ed Goetz, a sociologist, sees the ambivalence about maintaining public housing as a reflection of racial divides in the U.S.
There was a great deal more support for public housing before it became associated with a quote-unquote welfare-dependent population, before it became associated with largely non-white population. Its stigma is associated with the types of people who are most dependent on public housing. And in most cities, that's people of color and people who have trouble finding a position in the labor force.
Without addressing patterns of racial discrimination, Goetz fears public housing will continue to be seen not as a valuable resource,
but rather as something that we'd like to see go away.
For Lawrence Brown of Morgan State, the demolition of public housing paves the way for gentrification.
This is valuable property. It's all about real estate.
We're back at McCullough Homes, where two apartment buildings will be rehabbed through RAD.
This is the first city to sort of employ RAD on such a large level. That's all the remainder of the high-rises in the city. And a lot of them are elders and where seniors live. So in 20 or 30 or 40 years, you won't have a lot of opposition because most of the people that live there won't be alive anymore. No matter what this looks like, you're actually sitting on a gold mine, and you need to do everything you can to stay where you are and to take control of it if you can.
Brown says he hopes residents can take ownership of the RAD process to win a better affordable housing system, because both the private and the public sector have failed poor African Americans in Baltimore. As the city moves forward with RAD, there's a lot at stake. Is partnering with private entities an investment in public housing's long-term affordability and the communities that depend on it? Or is it another step in the too familiar process of dismantling poor Black communities?
Producer Jonna McCone reported this story with an Equal Voice Journalism Fellowship from the Marguerite Casey Foundation and the Journalism Center on Children and Families. Thanks to former Maryland Morning intern Brandon Block for his help on the story.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. That's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. On Friday, we talked to an entrepreneur and director of food policy for Baltimore City about the challenges of food access and food insecurity in Baltimore. This morning, another conversation about food, this time from a global perspective. My guest is Dr. Ruth Faden. She's the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics and the co-principal investigator of the Global Food Ethics Project. This is an international team of researchers, ethicists, nutritionists, and people who study a wide variety of areas related to food policy, and in particular, the ethical challenges of feeding an ever-growing human population. And is it ever growing? In 25 years, there may be more than 9.5 billion people inhabiting this planet, and keeping everyone fed with safe, nutritious food will give rise to many thorny ethical issues as we attempt to produce enough good food to satisfy that incredible need. Dr. Faden's team has just issued a report called the 7x5 Agenda for Ethics and Global Food Security, which suggests 7 projects that can be undertaken in the next 5 years to address the complex issues around global food security. She joins us on the line from Massachusetts. Ruth Faden, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
So why ethics and food?
It's pretty straightforward, actually, Tom. When you start thinking at all about how we can feed, as you say, as much as 9.5 billion people, the answers, as you start to think about them, all raise kind of trade-offs between values. So to give you a quick example, it's a pretty straightforward thing to raise enough food to feed everybody if we don't care about the impact of how we produce that food on the environment. But we do care, right? So one ethical challenge is how to strike the balance between protecting the environment in a context of climate change and producing enough food. It would also be an easy trick, maybe not an easy trick, but more straightforward, to produce enough food if we were indifferent to the impact of how we raise that food on, for example, the farm workers and farmers whose labor produces the food. So if we were indifferent to farm standards and worker protection, we could pretty quickly get enough food. Similarly, if we were indifferent to animal welfare, if we didn't care at all about how it is that livestock are treated, we'd probably be okay as well. So this is just to illustrate that once you start thinking at all hard about how it is, in fact, that we will get to this goal, this moral imperative of global food security, we realize that we've got to make some very ethically challenging trade-offs.
And it's a fascinating endeavor to think about what those challenges are. And I found that the 7 projects that you're suggesting are really quite fascinating. The one that sticks out to me in a big way is the ethics of meat consumption,
yes,
particularly in high-income and middle-income countries. So how much meat we consume as a species, how does that impact these ethical decisions that we've got to make?
So there's been a controversy for a long time. And almost, I would imagine, many of our listeners right now are either vegetarians or vegans, or have friends who are vegetarians and vegans and have been involved in many dining room table conversations about, is it ethically okay to eat meat? That is to say, is it all right to kill another animal in order that we as a species enjoy a better or better meal or a more nutritious one? That debate is probably not one that is resolvable. That is to say, people have very deep views about the ethics of whether it's appropriate to eat non-human animals. And we might leave it as an unresolved debate, except for one thing. Eating meat is not only ethically controversial from the standpoint of the rights and interests of the animals we are eating, but it also has a profound impact on the environment. It turns out that the pace at which we currently eat meat and dairy, I have to throw dairy in here as well, produces more greenhouse gases than all of the transportation sector combined. That is, you could take all the emissions from vehicles on the road, airplanes, boats, combine them all up together, and the impact in terms of greenhouse gases doesn't come close to the impact that the livestock production results in. Most of us don't appreciate that. We've all been, I think, well educated or informed about the impact of the transportation sector. We've had all this focus on fuel-efficient cars and carbon sequestering in that sector, but not when it comes to the eating of meat and dairy.
And Americans account for an awful lot of the consumption of meat and dairy, about 4.5% of the world's population, but we're eating 15% of the meat. So this is a particularly germane issue for our country and our public policy.
Yes, absolutely. That's correct. We are huge consumers of meat and dairy, and, you know, meat and dairy tastes good.
And your project, then, would concern what, then? You wish to shape the conversation about this? What do you hope to achieve in this particular aspect of your suggestions?
What we want to do in this project is put to the side, for purposes of expanding public conversation, this controversy about the ethics of eating meat, and instead focus on two other important values where there's more consensus. One is human health. So how much of what kinds of meat and dairy products should we be eating in order to have optimum nutrition? And that's a hugely debatable and controversial area right there. And then also, how should we think about what we can do to reduce meat consumption once we figure out how much meat and dairy people at different points in the life cycle should have for good nutrition. And some people will argue that zero, and other people will argue, no, there is a place for meat and dairy in the diet. Once we figure that out, then we can take that and we can look at it in terms of the kinds of impacts on climate change and the environment that we've just been discussing and determine what our target should be. So once we know what the target consumption rate should be for meat and dairy, taking both health and environmental impact into consideration, then we have to think about the ethics of what we can do to moderate or influence people's consumption of meat and dairy so we get closer to that target range.
Dr. Ruth Faden is the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics and a professor of biomedical ethics at Hopkins. She led the team that came up with a report released just last week called the 7x5 Projects to Achieve Global Food Security in the Next 5 Years, or at least influence the conversation thereof. So, Ruth, we're not going to get to all seven of the projects that you're recommending. We talked about meat consumption and its impact on the environment and human health. One of the projects concerns labeling. And I think this is something that's very important to a lot of folks. You know, you go into a store and you see things called organic or, you know, certified humane or fair trade. But your suggestion in this project is to sort of codify and organize this in a better and more accurate way.
Exactly so. So some of these labels are terrific. They stand for or reflect very carefully researched operations that are quite serious and reliable and clear about what they're vouchsafing. Others, not so much. And most products that you might be interested in buying or most foods that you'd be interested in buying will have some, but not all. So some would have the USDA organic on it. Some might say fair trade certified. Some might say environmentally friendly, but you can't get it all at once. What we're proposing is essentially to create a mega system, if you like, of certifications and labels that would be kind of one-stop shopping for the consumer so that I could go to my supermarket, whether it's a big box store or it's a boutique, and I would be able to look at a product, pick it up, hold it, and be able to see with one glance where the product stood on a range of ethical values, food safety, sustainable farming practices, that would be the environment, labor standards, animal welfare would be the principal ones. And what we are proposing here is not to replace the certification and labeling that is currently working well, but to aggregate them in a way to make it easier for the consumer, and also where the labels are not so accurate or not so clear, to replace them. And if we really are successful, what we're envisioning is a way in which you could scan the product and be able to see the breakdown. So if I'm really interested in labor standards and want to make sure that it's all fair trade and that there's no child labor involved in this product, I can see that. If I'm interested in animal welfare practices, I can see that. If I'm interested in food safety, I'll be able to see that disaggregated with a sort of scan with my smartphone.
One of the projects has to do with climate smart agriculture that is also climate just. And in the report, you make the point that in tropical regions, for example, the places that are most often hit by droughts and extreme weather events, they have a huge need for climate smart agriculture. But to be climate smart and climate just is often difficult for people in less affluent circumstances. What is the distinction between climate smart and climate just?
It's a very critical distinction from our point of view. So it's extremely exciting that over the past year or so, this language of climate smart agriculture has taken on a life of its own. It represents, in fact, an international agreement that came out in 2014, sponsored by the United Nations, that is a commitment on the part of a significant number of nations across the world and many more organizations to work together to try to develop more aggressively, more rapidly, new technologies in farming and agricultural practices that are both kinder to the environment, that will have less of a negative impact on the environment, and that are also adaptive, more adaptive to the changes of in our climate that are sadly inevitable. So this is all great. This is all really, really good. It's important, very, very important, that we find better ways to both adapt agricultural practices to our changing climate and also do what we can to mitigate the impact of the agricultural sector on climate change. The problem about the difference between climate smart and climate just is recognizing that the impact of climate change on the world is not distributed evenly, that there are parts of the world where the burden of climate change now and in the future will fall most heavily on the world's most disadvantaged farmers and the world's poorest people who rely on those farmers heavily for their basic survival. So if you think about where people are poorest in the world, that's where climate change is going to be the most destructive. The areas that hug around the equator, especially, for example, huge swaths of Africa. What we need to do to make climate smart, climate just, is ensure that the benefits of these new technologies will be experienced by the world's most disadvantaged farmers, and also that they will be able to afford them and that they will be the right kinds of technologies that will help them in their particular circumstances. So it's not as if climate change is going to affect all food producers equally. It will hit hardest the people who always suffer the most, which is the world's most disadvantaged.
Dr. Ruth Faden is the director of the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute of Bioethics and a professor of biomedical ethics at Hopkins. She is the co-principal investigator of the Global Food Ethics Project, which has just released an agenda for global food security. We've got a link to the report and more on the seven projects that it recommends, as well as a link to blog posts with more information. If you'd like to explore this subject further, come to wipr.org/Maryland Morning. Ruth Faden, you always give us so much to think about. Appreciate your time. Thanks.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Next up, a theater review with J. Wynn Russick. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Theater critic J. Wynn Russick is here, as she is every Monday morning, with her weekly review. This time she's been to the Fells Point Corner Theater to catch their production of Last of the Boys.
Stephen Dietz's 2004 play, Last of the Boys, is about the impact of the Vietnam War on those who fought and those who were left behind. The play is part ghost story, part buddy play, part parent-child conflict. It's also complex, time-shifting, and occasionally surreal. At Fells Point Corner Theater, director Barry Feinstein has cast some first-rate actors, but he hasn't found a clear path through this thorny text. The opening seems simple enough. Jeter, played by Tony Calavito with long gray hair, John Lennon sunglasses, bandana tied around his head, shows up at the home of his friend, Ben. The two men fought side by side in Vietnam 3 decades ago, but their lives have taken different paths since then. Jeter is a college professor who specializes in teaching the 60s. Calavito plays him as a compulsive talker, a man obsessed with the era. Mark Squirek plays Jeter's friend Ben as far more reserved, nearly a recluse. He lives in the last remaining trailer in a deserted mobile home park on a toxic site in California. Designer Bush Greenbeck's set depicts these rundown quarters with ramshackle detail. When Jeter arrives, he's just come from Ben's father's funeral, which Ben chose not to attend.
If I'm not mistaken, if I'm not just a victim of your foul mood and your increasingly marginal beer, this is still planet Earth. Am I right?
Forget it!
As is the custom on planet Earth, when the son's father dies, the son is expected to make an appearance at the funeral. No matter how messy the past, how great the estrangement, there is this tacit understanding that the son will find some time to throw a little dirt on the box.
Ben's father, we soon learn, worked at Ford Motor Company for Robert McNamara before McNamara became Secretary of Defense in 61. It's a bit of history, deeply personal history for Ben, that turns out to literally haunt him. At various junctures in the play, film of McNamara is projected on the side of Ben's trailer. A young soldier appears and helps Ben into a corporate-style jacket and tie. Then Ben mysteriously takes on McNamara's persona, holding a press conference, or responding to questions from the ghostly soldier, played here by Adam Zollner.
Mr. Secretary, was there any attempt to warn the civilian population?
To warn them?
Yes, sir.
There was no special effort to warn them, no.
I see.
These attacks happened during daylight, did they not?
Yes, sir.
Then the civilian population had every opportunity to be fully aware of them.
Including actual footage of McNamara helps set these sections apart, but it's not enough. There's a thin line between intriguing the viewer and confusing him. This production crosses that line. It's difficult to tell if these otherworldly scenes are all in Ben's mind since the war, or if they've been triggered by his father's death. Additional clues, like larger lighting changes, could help us grasp the truly disturbing transformation Ben undergoes. Playwright Dietz adds a melodramatic note near the end of the play. This resolves the parent-child conflicts a bit too neatly. But considering some of the perplexing events leading up to it, a neat resolution is rather welcome. Dietz is a prolific playwright whose work has been produced by area theaters from Everyman to Olney. His subject matter ranges widely. In Last of the Boys, the way he intermingles the real and the supernatural meets with mixed results at Fells Point Corner. But one lesson comes through with undeniable clarity. The fallout from war, any war, is messy, and it carries over from generation to generation.
There's something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
Last of the Boys is at the Fells Point Corner Theater in Baltimore until Sunday. We've got more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Theater critic Jay Wynn Russick joins us every Monday morning with her theater reviews. On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Tom Hall. Lots more ahead. Stay with us.
There's battle lines being drawn. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speak in their minds. Are getting so much resistance from behind. Time we stop.
Is there an issue you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or leave us a voicemail at 410-881-3162. Visit us on the web to leave comments or to hear previous episodes. Again, that's wypr.org/Maryland Morning.
Welcome back to Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. Andy Abramowitz was born in Owings Mills and lived most of his growing up years here in Baltimore, went away to college, but had the good sense to come back to the University of Maryland for law school. Along the way, he played in some bands and listened to a lot of music, experiences indispensable for Abramowitz's debut novel out this month. Thank You, Good Night is the story of a one-hit wonder band reuniting a decade after they broke up. Their rivalries, regrets, and motivations pull us along with them into a very funny examination of what's important in life. Andy Abramowitz joins us on the line from his home in Philadelphia. Welcome to Maryland Morning.
Thank you, Sheila. Great to be here.
Another way of describing your first novel might be every mid-career Philadelphia lawyer's fantasy of telling his firm to take this job and shove it, I'm going to be a rock star.
Those are your words, not mine.
Well, is that what's going on?
No, not at all. Not at all. I work for a great law firm. Good people, great lawyers. This is in no respect a take this job and shove it. This is just a creative outlet at best that happened to go a little bit further than anybody planned. But no, this is not some sort of exit strategy. Not at all.
But that is sort of what your lead character, Teddy Tremble, does. He's the almost 40 lawyer who used to front for a band. The band he put together and named after himself, Tremble. What's Teddy Tremble up to when we meet him?
Teddy Tremble is one of the major differences between Teddy Tremble and myself is that Teddy Tremble is a one-hit wonder. He's a one-hit wonder from his 90s band, Tremble. I'm a no-hit wonder, so there's nothing that I'm trying to return to. But he is. He is simply being a lawyer, a little bit bitter about it, that the band never went as far as he wanted it to. And he finds out from one of his former bandmates that he hasn't spoken to in 10 years that there is an art exhibit hanging in the Tate Modern in London. And that's all the information he gets about it, but he is very curious because it somehow implicates his legacy. So he goes over to London and he checks it out, and it's kind of a mockery of him. It's a terrible photograph of him. He's eating nachos and he's a mess. He's a slob. He looks like a loser. At least he thinks he does. So that starts, it puts him sort of face to face with what he perceives to be his legacy, and he doesn't like it one bit.
And as soon as he realizes that, he goes off to Switzerland, of all places, to confront the photographer who made that photo, and stumbles onto this sort of rabid group pocket of fans,
right,
who remember every song that Tremble ever recorded and have all these questions, and they're incredibly committed to this band that he has hardly thought much about for 10 years.
Right.
Why is that so important?
Well, by the time we catch up with Teddy Tremble, he's a little bit bitter, but he's kind of put all of this to bed and he's kind of moved on. But seeing that there's this lunatic fringe on the other side of the world that is still, for lack of a better term, grooving to his music, and sort of demanding that he give them an impromptu concert, it kind of reawakens all these old feelings in him. And he comes back from that trip somewhat energized to write again. He hadn't done that since the band broke up. And it awakens all these old feelings that he had thought were long dead and buried.
And then we meet Teddy's bandmates as he visits them one by one to persuade them to record another album and to tour with it. So many idiosyncrasies, we can't talk about all of them. But where did these characters come from?
They are purely works of fiction. I did play in bands. I never had anybody like the guitar player that's described, this jumbo jet character, the buffoon. They were all, I always played with great musicians and good friends. These folks were really just, I had to put the crazy guy in there, because I think whenever you're writing about or reading about musicians, you have this latitude. We feel like we can tolerate sort of more off-the-wall personality traits in musicians. So I needed to have the crazy guy. I needed to have, the other two who had sort of gone on and changed their lives and made something of their lives and had moved on, and who were not ready to be talked back into the game.
That's lawyer and writer Andy Abramowitz here on Maryland Morning 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about his debut novel, Thank You, Good Night. He'll be speaking about it Wednesday evening at the Ivy Bookshop. Teddy's girlfriend, Sarah Rome, is such an enigma through most of the novel, so melancholy. I'm not quite sure what holds them together. Is she in the story because Teddy needs her, or did you need her in some way in this story?
I think Teddy needs her. I think that Teddy is, he's a bit of a jerk. He's kind of self-interested, and everything is sort of about him. And he has this woman in his life who has a sort of a much darker past than he certainly does. And even though they've been living together for 10 years, he really hasn't seen it. He hasn't paid a whole lot of attention to it. So she needs some things to happen in her life that force him to appreciate her, that force him to at least decide whether or not she's the one. And that kind of helps him along to sort of get to where he needs to be and either make peace with his past and his present or not.
At least four times in this book, usually when things aren't going well or he's just bored, Teddy tells himself, quote, "One day I'll die, and this will be one of the things I did with my time." First time is a Dublin bar with a blowhard who can't even remember his kids' birthdays. Seems to tell us a lot about Teddy's worry that he's wasting his life. How did that phrase come to you, or was it yours already?
I think the first time I wrote it was in that scene in Dublin, and I've sort of meant it, I guess I intended it to be kind of funny how he's laughing at this fool for not remembering the ages of his kids. And this is sort of a moment in his life that just like any other moment. But I kept coming back to it because, I don't know, it just sort of struck me as a way that, you know, I feel like we never appreciate significant moments in our lives while they're happening. And this is just sort of one way to put everything in context, that this is a moment. It doesn't need to be anything momentous, but it's a moment just like anything else. And at the end, this will be something that I did with my time, and it will be as important as anything else I did with my time.
You are getting great reviews for this first novel. Is there a second one on the way?
There is a second one on the way. It's a little ways out, but I'm hard at work on it.
Good luck.
Thanks so much.
Andy Abramowitz is a Philadelphia lawyer who got his law degree in his hometown, Baltimore. His new first novel is Thank You, Good Night. He'll be speaking about it Wednesday, 7 p.m. at the Ivy Bookshop on Falls Road. We've got more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast. Maryland Morning is an original production of Your Public Radio,
WYPR,
in Baltimore.
The show is produced by Matt Purdy
and Jonna McCone.
Nathan Sterner directs and engineers.
I'm Tom Hall.
And I'm Sheila Cast. On this day in history, 1937, the planned community of Greenbelt in Prince George's County was chartered as part of President Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal. We'll be back Wednesday. Please join us.